Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. Welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. With Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Coming up, how do politicians decide where to eat when they come to town? And we'll hear a saxophonist's journey from adjunct professor to temporary rock star. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
And if anyone has more confidence in elections in Russia and Middle Eastern countries not named Israel, that is a joke. That is a joke.
You know what? Then our election in America is a joke, and Maricopa is a joke.
Go ahead with Russia. Have fun voting in Russia. See how that goes.
We have an agreement with the president that our nominees will get a fair consideration, and I'm glad they're finally at the table on this.
If the court were to take this off of the ballot at this point, that would be a real injustice to the hundreds of thousands of Arizona voters who said they want to be able to, you know, make their choice in November.
It'll go to two things. One, Title I funds for the schools that have the most students in poverty, and also money that we can use for school improvement for schools that have low proficiency rates to train teachers, train leadership, and so on.
And with me to talk about a win and a loss for supporters of the abortion rights ballot measure, a deal between Governor Hobbs and state Senate Republicans and more, are Chuck Coughlin of High Ground. Good morning, Chuck.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks, Mark.
And a Democratic strategist, Tony Connie. Tony, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Chuck, this week with the abortion rights initiative, as I mentioned, a win and a loss, they were certified as having enough signatures. However, the state Supreme Court overruled a lower court judge and said that the phrase unborn human being would be allowed to be in the publicity pamphlet that will be sent to all voters across the state. So, on balance, good week, bad week? What do you think?
It's on the ballot. I mean, it's a victory. We're discussing the publicity pamphlet, which is mailed out by the Secretary of State to all the voters in Arizona. And you have arguments in there. And it is a good resource. But they're objecting to some phrases in there which do exist in statute, and so it wasn't an outrageous ruling by the court. It found a rational basis for maintaining Ledge Counsel's description, but I can understand why they. But, you know, all in all, hey man, we're all going to get to vote on it, which is the most important thing.
Yeah, Tony, do you agree with that?
I half agree with that. I mean, this is more signatures than have ever been submitted ever for this initiative because it's got broad support. But it's very clear that when they wrote this description out of the legislature, the reason they did it was to try and unfairly influence people. Yeah. The first court said, hey, look, this is obviously a political term. And then the Supreme Court, big surprise, if there's any doubt about how politicized this court has been since Ducey packed it, they decided that, no, we should let this phrase be on the pamphlet. I don't think that it's going to make a huge impact for voters. And I think part of it is because over the past couple of years, voters have seen that the people that argue against abortion rights, they've lost all credibility. They've lost so much credibility. They said all the things they said that will not happen if Roe went away has happened. Women's lives have been in danger. People are talking about not allowing folks to go over state lines to get abortions, like all of these things that they said that wouldn't happen is happening. And so when it comes down to it, that's a tough position, a tough situation for the people that want this to fail that they're in, because I just think that voters want to preserve these rights, take it out of the legislature, put it in the Constitution.
Well, so Chuck, you said it's on the ballot, and it is for now. There is still a lawsuit from Arizona Right to Life that's challenging having this on the ballot. Given what Tony said about the state Supreme Court, which is the same court that ruled that the 1864 abortion law should take effect, do you think there's a chance the court could kick this off the ballot?
I don't. I don't see a rational basis for them to get there. I have my own litigation in front of the court right now on our Make Elections Fair initiative,
yeah,
which is also a ballot analysis mm-hmm. case. And so we'll find out. But I think we're going to get I can't see a rationale in which they would remove as Tony just so eloquently said, hundreds of thousands of people who have signed petitions to want to express their desire to have a vote on this.
So, Tony, speaking of ballot measures, the state Supreme Court this week also said that the border security measure referred by the state legislature, by the legislative Republicans specifically, would be allowed to stay on the ballot. This was another single subject rule challenge. We've been talking about whether, you know, the abortion rights measure is sort of seen as a big driver for Democratic turnout. Maybe the border security measure is seen as a big turnout driver for Republican support. Given that, at least right now, they're both going to be on the ballot, how do you see the turnout models based on both of those?
I think the immigration one is probably more of a messaging opportunity for the Republicans than it is a turnout push. I think obviously something that that a lot of their voters are focused on. But when you look at the numbers, the types of voters that are animated the most by that initiative, a higher percentage of them are regular voters. On the other hand, the types of voters who are motivated by the abortion initiative tend to be younger, tend to be women, tend to be voters that in the past have needed more of a reason to show up to the polls. And so I think that on balance, if you're looking at the two, that the abortion initiative is probably going to drive turnout more. But being such a huge battleground state in such a important, every level of the election is being contested right now. From legislature to presidential, I think turnout's going to be so high anyway that I don't know how much of a difference it would make. But when you, as a Democrat, like Biden won by 10,000 votes, I'll take a little bit more.
The margins matter, right?
Because these tiny margins do matter, yeah.
So, Chuck, I want to ask you, because we've seen a few of these single subject rule challenges, including one on your Make Elections Fair.
Yes.
and the courts have basically ruled against those challenges in all cases. So, like, what does that tell you about what initiative supporters can do or what the legislature can do in terms of putting a bunch of things into an initiative or a law maybe, yeah, and not having it run afoul of the single subject rule?
As long as they're interrelated, as long as they're related to a single topic, I mean, that's generally the rule. That's the precedential nature of what the court looks at. And as long as you can tie it to one single purpose, in our Make Elections Fair case, it's treating every voter the same. It's treating every candidate the same, and it's elections.
Right. They're all candidate elections, the judge said.
It's all related to the same topic. That follows the precedents that come before. I think people get confused about, you can't have multiple amendments to the Constitution. If they're related, you're going to pass muster, and I suspect we'll pass muster later this week. We've already won at the trial court level with Make Elections Fair. We had an amicus brief filed yesterday by former Governor Symington and former Speaker of the House Rusty Bowers in favor of Make Elections Fair on the same topic, mentioning their legislative histories, things that they have done that are very complicated. And the narrative there is, we live in very modern times. There's very complicated issues that are here. And as long as they're interrelated and form a narrative of their own, you'll pass the test.
So one other election thing I want to get to before the break, and I want to start, Tony, with you. We saw in CD1, the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, listed former State Representative Amish Shah in their red to blue program, which basically suggests that this is a race in which the National Democrats will be spending money. CD1 has been seen as a potential pickup opportunity for Democrats going up against a longtime incumbent, David Schweikert. Does the move, like the formalization of him in this program, does that matter at all, or is it just sort of saying out loud what a lot of people had already thought?
I think it matters because it shows that it's a priority. And so it's a signal to other donors, to other organizations, hey, this is a race that you should invest in. We've done the research. This is a place where you're going to be able to pick up seats. And so, yeah, I do think it matters. It's going to be a tough race either way. I think that with the additional enthusiasm that Democrats have right now since Harris became the nominee, I think Schweikert's in a tougher position than he was in a month ago. It's going to be a really important race.
Well, and, the sort of the conventional wisdom is having a primary can be sort of a good practice, right, for going in the general election. This was, a six-way primary,
yeah,
which with a lot of sort of well-known candidates in it. Does that help Shaw now going against a very tough campaigner and a good fundraiser in David Schweikert?
Yeah, I think it does, just because, you know, he had only run at the legislative level before. He did very well, and now he came out ahead in that race. He's been talking to voters at the doors during the primary, so he's got a good sense of what voters care about. And then now his campaign team is going to have to do a much bigger sort of media-based, more modern campaign in addition to his door-knocking in order to win. And I think he's going to be positioned to do that, and also because he's going to be raising a ton of money with the enthusiasm from him winning.
So, Chuck, if you're the Schweikert campaign, is Shaw the candidate that you wanted to face, the candidate you didn't want to face?
I think it's better than facing a woman. And I think Marlene, I think, was more, they were more fearful of that in the cycle because it creates more contrast. Dr. Shaw, as Tony just said, is known as a door knocker. He just got out of a very competitive race where he won, I think, with less than 25% of the vote. So you have a divided, potentially divided Democratic field. But it's going to be difficult for Schweikert to penetrate that audience. As Tony said, the district is going to evolve blue over the coming years. Mm-hmm. It's moving in that direction like Sinema's old district did, and now Congressman Stanton's district. It's part of that purple area that runs down the middle of the 101 and Maricopa County that is shifting. And they drew the lines farther into Phoenix. And so he's picked up more Phoenix voters, and it's more of a Maricopa County district now. And so it's going to be harder and harder for him to compete in that district.
All right. That is Chuck Coughlin. I'm also joined by Tony Cotti. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It is the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guests this week, Democratic strategist Tony Cotti and Chuck Coughlin of High Ground. So, Chuck, I guess maybe this says something about the state of politics when a former Republican governor of the state, it's news that such a person endorses the Republican nominees for president and U.S. Senate in his state. But such is the way in the place we're in now. Former Governor Doug Ducey announced this week that he was endorsing former President Trump and U.S. Senate candidate Kerry Lake. And this somehow is noteworthy.
It's noteworthy because, you know, the former president threw the governor under the bus during the contested election, called him all kinds of names. And he also endorsed Kerry Lake, who threw him under the bus, called him all kinds of names. I saw that and I chuckled because Doug has a role with the Common Sense Institute now in his post-gubernatorial career. And I'm like, that probably doesn't make a lot of common sense to most people out there. But, you know, as a political creature, I'm reminded consistently that the way we vote today, politics is a team sport. You're either on the team or you're not on the team. And so, you know, what choice does he have if he wants to play a role in a role? I would have ducked. I would be like, nah, not my cup of tea. I'm not going to do this.
Which is kind of what he did 2 years ago,
yeah,
right? Like he endorsed Karen Taylor Robeson in the GOP gubernatorial primary and didn't really say much when Kerry Lake won that. Like,
right,
we don't, maybe he voted for Lake. We don't know.
Yeah.
But, and it's not our business. But
well,
he didn't say, I'm okay, she's the nominee of my party, I'm endorsing her.
And the same with Karen. When Karen lost, she never endorsed Lake, mm-hmm, after that for all the things that Lake had said.
She has since.
Now she's come around on that. And, you know, I think it's hard for a lot of people to see that and have respect for that type of maneuver outside of the confines of the very narrow Republican primary voter. And you're just not going to get any love from those people. They're just not going to come back around. It's not like, oh, Doug's a really good guy, I'm going to go support him again. Or Karen's my cup of tea. It doesn't fit. And so, you know, I've been around this business for a long time, Mark. You know, my God, I'll admit to my sins of I ran Russell Pierce's campaigns at a point in time because he was a valuable member of the Republican Party at a point in time and helping Governor Symington win a very tight election in 1994. And he was a good guy. And I always maintained a relationship with him throughout his life and towards the end of his life, even. We didn't agree on everything, but, you know, we talked. And so, but I don't even get that kind of sense here that there's a dialogue between the Trump folks and the Ducey folks, or the Lake folks and the Ducey folks, or conversely, the Taylor Robeson folks. Yeah. It's a different world we live in today.
Tony, was it surprising to you to see that Governor Ducey endorse Trump and Lake?
It wasn't. I was upset that he did, but it wasn't surprising. I mean, don't forget that he is the person who raised over $500,000 to get Senator Wendy Rogers elected to the legislature. And now we've seen what that's done. And so, you know, I do think that one of Doug Ducey's greatest sort of legacies isn't going to be the legislation as he passed. It's going to be the silence as these far right wing people took over the Republican Party. Chuck said it's a team sport. And I think Chuck is right. But the teams are democracy versus not democracy. The teams are sanity versus chaos. And you know, and Ducey said, you know, well, we're going to get past squabbles. It's not a squabble to try and overthrow the results of an election. That's not a issue difference. That's mm-hmm. not. And so I do think that he's thinking about his political future, maybe, or perhaps donors of the organization that he runs care about this. But I do think that in the end, voters are going to look at this and they're going to think, oh, this guy, he just doesn't have any values. He doesn't have a backbone. And I think that's part of the reason why he went from being one of the most popular governors in America to one of the least popular when he left office.
And it's not – Tony's right. The teams have changed. The jersey color has changed from GOP and the friendly little elephant to MAGA. The Republican Party today is a MAGA party. It's not your father's GOP. It's not your father's Buick anymore. It's a very different place.
And you saw a bunch of the sort of MAGA influencers and elected officials taking a victory lap when Ducey made this announcement saying, hey, look, we beat the McCain wing of the party. They're now coming to us. And I think that that's not what people want to see. It's very frustrating.
And it's the reason the fastest growing part of the electorate are unaffiliated voters.
Right.
It is the fastest growing part of the electorate.
Yeah.
Previously, because of the identity politics that the left was espousing, you know, that identity through your, you know, gender, you know, not value based stuff. And now it's the Republican Party doing the same thing. It's identity politics of the Republicans.
One last thing
and
I'd say
about
this.
People flee from that. They don't want to be a part of
it. One thing I'm interested
that.
Is like it's no secret that Ducey and Robeson were going around saying all kinds of bad things about these two people last year. And so the people who they've talked to that are in their circles that see this endorsement, I wonder if it's a signal to them that they need to pony up and get on board, or whether or not people are like, oh, well, I guess they're just not who they said they were.
All right, guys, just a few minutes left. I want to ask you about a deal this week reached between Governor Katie Hobbs and the state Senate Republicans over her nominees to lead state agencies. The governor is saying, okay, the president has said, you know, he will treat my nominees with more respect. They'll have hearings and get votes. And the Senate president says, sure, if she sends us better nominees. The governor says, I'm probably going to send you the same nominees I did before. Chuck, are we just back at square one here?
No, because we have an election. She is very aware.
So is she hedging then?
Oh, yeah. I think that she'll play along regardless, but I think she's very much hopeful that Warren Peterson will not be the president of the Senate. There will no longer be Jake Hoffman's committee. It will go back to the way it was, where appointees go. The transportation director goes to the transportation committee. The health committee chair, the access director goes to the health, you know, the DOA director goes to government committee. That's what we'll go back to under a change of leadership in the Senate. And, you know, odds of that happening are pretty good that, you know, I could at least see a 15-15 tie. That's a very realistic scenario. And I think she's saying, OK, I'll play along until November and we'll see how these cards shake out.
Tony, is there a risk, though, that if Republicans are still in control of state government come January, that there is still a committee led by Senator Jake Hoffman, who is still going to do the same kind of hearings to her nominees that they did last year.
Yeah, and we're under the assumption he's not going to prison for being a fake elector, I think, in this scenario. But
assume he's still in the legislature.
So, yeah, I mean, look, yeah, there's a risk. But one thing that the governor did both in her campaign and since is she knows that these are not good faith negotiators, that these people are not thinking about what's good for the state. You know, I mean, you have Governor Brewer, as conservative as they come, who is somebody who cares about the powers of the governor, but she also really knows the legislature from her time there. And I've heard her come out and say, boy, what they're doing with these nominees doesn't make any sense. It's bad for government. I think that that's the position of most people, unless you're in that 20% that just thinks that you need to stop government working no matter what in order to make Donald Trump people happy.
So, Chuck, before we go, let's put the cart several miles before the horse, all right? Let's say that there's a 15-15 split. Obviously, that would require some kind of power-sharing agreement. We've seen it before in the state Senate. Does this become one of the issues that Democrats and Republicans have to negotiate over?
Yeah, it will be it will be that issue. And you will see those aforementioned MAGA candidates, Peterson and others, won't be in leadership. You'd see David Gowen, you know, in a power sharing agreement with Fernandez. And under that circumstances, I say this committee goes away. Jake Hoffman, regardless if Tony's right, he's in prison. He's not going to be the chairman of a committee. He will not be the chairman of that committee for sure. And they resolve it that way.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Chuck Coughlin, Tony Connie, thanks to you both for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Vice President Kamala Harris and her running mate Tim Walz were in the Valley late last week, rallying with thousands of supporters at Desert Diamond Arena in Glendale. But they also made another stop in the Valley after their rally at Cochina Atomex, a Mexican spot on 7th Avenue in downtown Phoenix. And it continued a long tradition of candidates eating at Mexican restaurants when they swing through Phoenix, from George Bush to Bill Clinton to Barack Obama. But how do they decide where they're going to go? And what are the politics that play into it? For more on that, I sat down with someone who's worked on a lot of campaigns in Arizona, longtime Politico Krista Severns.
Well, it's like a pageant or like the Miss America contest, because you've got many things you're working on. You've got security. You've got location, because you don't want to go someplace that's halfway across the valley just for a meal. That means you've got a motorcade through, you know, two freeways. So you're pissing off everybody with that. So you've got to look for a location that's near something else that you're doing. And then you get a message. So if you'll notice in pageants, the prettiest girl doesn't always win. Mm-hmm. The one that wins is the one that will be able to carry forth the duties in the princess way. And in this pageant, you're looking for a place that's not going to cause controversy,
okay,
but that will send across a message to a community. And also that the Secret Service can, you know, wrangle around and, you know, make safe.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so there's a lot of things you're balancing. Fair enough. Let's talk about some famous Arizona examples of this over
sure,
the years. This
sure.
goes back a little ways in sort of presidential campaign history. Mm-hmm. What are the first ones that come to mind for you?
Dick's Hideaway,
yes.
Which was George Bush. Mm-hmm. And that one I got to give him credit for. I thought that was pretty cool. Because
yeah.
Dick's Hideaway is a hideaway. And they went with the McCains. Mm-hmm. The McCains live in the neighborhood. And so it sent a message. I don't think the McCains and the Bushes were actually getting along at that point. But, you know, they were out there doing their meal. And so the message there was clear. And it was before, I think, the Kerry debate. And it was Mexican food. It hit all of the buttons on that one. But again, that's like the coolest place I've seen a candidate go. Because
okay.
there are some.
What are some of those examples?
Ponchos, Bill Clinton. Now, the rumor at that point was that they were going to go to Los Dos Molinos,
right.
which is just down the street. I believe, though, the rumor got out about that. And Secret Service said, no, too many people have heard of it, or we're going to be there. We got to go somewhere else.
Okay.
Which is how they got to Ponchos. That's on, you know, down in South Central, and they had been down somewhere near there for an event. And, you know, you could go in there, and there's a picture of Bill Clinton on the wall
yep.
where he sat.
often presidential tables will follow this, yes, after these visits, right? Some little placard at the table. What about when Obama came to the Valley and went to Macayo's? This was controversial with local food critics at the time. What's your take?
Oh, Macayo's is an Arizona institution. It's a family-owned business. And it was in a good location.
Yeah.
It was near where they had to be. So it was perfect. Again, they're not going to these restaurants for the best food of whatever it is. They're going because it's going to be reliable. It's, you know, the Secret Service says it's okay, and the message is okay.
Yeah. What about more recently? In the last election cycle, we saw President Biden here a couple of times, and Vice President Harris. They went to Barrio Cafe with Silvana Salcido, who, you know, has recently closed. But that was a very political choice, it seemed to me.
But it was also a great choice because here is a woman who has made it, won many culinary awards, and the food is good, and trying to send, you know, a message of support for women chefs and Mexican food.
Yeah. And Mexican food. Okay.
Mark it up.
Right. So we have to talk about this. It's always Mexican food, it seems,
always,
in Arizona, which makes sense in a certain way. I mean, first of all, just because we have great Mexican food, but we also have a large population of Latinos here in the Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Is this political? Is this like a you have to, like a rite of passage to come to Arizona and eat Mexican food?
You don't have to, but it's the safe bet. You know, they're not going to go to a chain. They're not going to Chili's.
Right.
And, you know, you need a local place. You need the local flavor. So
That's
why they defer to it. And usually they don't have a lot of time to figure it out either.
Hmm.
So either the national campaign gets a list of places or somebody here comes up with a couple.
There are some pitfalls to Mexican food, right? Like Tim Walz, when he was here, was joking about how he cannot eat spicy food. There's this story I read about that's sort of an infamous example of this when Gerald Ford went to Texas and tried to eat a tamale with the husk on. I mean, this is not without a little bit of risk.
Well, you know, everything has a little risk. So it's like when somebody orders a big glass of milk, you know, is their drink. Okay, is that an issue or not? You know, people talk about it, but in the long run, really, it's not going to be a big deal. But if someone did eat a tamale with the corn still on it, that would be a problem. And that advance person would get fired.
Yeah, because there is somebody whose job it is in the campaign to figure out what they're going to order, how they eat it, if there are any local pitfalls they might fall into, right?
Right. That is somebody's job.
That's so interesting.
It's all been figured out ahead of time.
Because it can turn into a meme so quickly today.
Mm, it was always an issue, but now it's really an issue with social media. Yeah. Mm. So I don't think you're going to see a lot of quinoa and salads because you're going to have, you know, it's going to get in people's teeth.
But this brings up a point, right? Quinoa, because that's sort of an upper crusty kind of food.
Mm-hmm.
There's a level of politics to this that I think is very interesting, like what it says about the candidate or what they're trying to portray about themselves with what they eat, where they go, and what they order, too.
Sure. All of this is really, it's based on polling.
Mm.
It's based on research, because you got to figure out, all right, how are you going to get more votes than the next guy? What are the groups of people you're appealing to? Who can you appeal to? You've got a base, and then you've got those people that maybe switch over or whatever. So the first thing you want to do is not offend anybody. Second thing you want to do is figure out, okay, does this work with the group that I'm looking at trying to appeal to me?
Mm. Another thing I want to ask, because this is kind of what I was thinking about when I was researching all of this, can they order a drink like a beer, a glass of wine, or is everybody going to be drinking lemonade at a restaurant if they're going on campaign?
It's a really good question. I mean, I've seen them wait until after they've left.
What?
So it's like, do you really want to see a picture of Tipper Gore holding a beer?
Sure.
I mean, I guess, it's fine. It's just, it just saves headaches.
Okay, so last question for you. Where would you send a candidate should they be coming through today?
I've been thinking about that. It's like, can we have a hot dog? Can we have a good burger?
Mm.
You know, can we go to Pizzeria Bianco? Can we do this more like Anthony Bourdain? Let's go to the Fry Bread House.
Oh,
it's
so
a James Beard Award winner. It's in, you know, Central Phoenix. Let's go someplace that tells our story in a new way.
In a new way. Mm-hmm. All right. Longtime Arizona Politico, Krista Severance. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. What a lot of fun.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody, and I'm joined now in studio by the show's Sam Dingman. Hey there, Sam.
Good morning. Mark, did you grow up with anybody or ever know anybody that became famous?
I can't think that I didn't, but I'm such a bad Facebook user that I'm sure somebody from Manchester High School has gone on to many people have gone on to great things. I just don't know about them.
Yeah, it's an odd, somewhat rare experience. There's a woman from my high school who had a brief run on SNL, and it's a strange thing to witness. It's somebody you know from the playground or the grocery store or your high school, all of a sudden they pop up on a movie poster or a TV screen.
Probably not something you and I have to worry about, right?
No, there is very little danger of that. But when it does happen, for the people it does happen to, I find myself going back to my early experiences with those people and trying to figure out if there were maybe clues that this is how their story was going to go. And earlier this summer, I got an important reminder that sometimes those clues can be misleading.
It's early June at the Arizona Financial Theater, and the Grammy-winning rock band Vampire Weekend is playing to a sold-out crowd of about 5,000 people. Even though I was explicitly told not to, I'm recording on my phone. It's early in the show, and one of the members of the band picks up his saxophone and plugs it into an effects pedal. When he finishes his solo, the crowd goes nuts. Now, I did not make this recording because I'm a huge Vampire Weekend fan. I like their music, but to be honest, I don't know a whole lot about Vampire Weekend. I do, however, know the guy who played that sax solo. His name is Colin Killily, and we have been friends since we were 12. I met up with him backstage a few hours before the show, and we hadn't seen each other in years. There was a lot to catch up on.
I'm not trying to James Lipton you right now, but I want to play you something. My mom found... this.
That is Colin and me in sixth grade playing our saxophones in the basement of his mom's house in Virginia. At the time, we knew each other a little bit from school and Little League baseball, but in my memory, this tape is the sound of us becoming friends.
So the reason, I don't know if you remember, but we had a name for that called Gliss.
We did?
That was Gliss.
Wow, edgy.
Edgy stuff, right? I
don't blame Colin if he doesn't remember Gliss. He's been in a lot of bands since then. But for me, that day in the basement was special. When Colin and I were kids, I always had this feeling, like I was hanging out with a celebrity who wasn't famous yet. The day the Red Hot Chili Peppers album, Californication, came out, Colin came over to my house, and I put the CD into my parents' stereo, and without a word, Colin picked up a guitar and just started playing along, even though he had never heard any of the songs before.
It always seemed like it was second nature to you. It just always seemed like you just, like, already knew it somehow.
Mm.
Did it ever feel that way to you?
I had good ears early on, and I knew that. Mm-hmm. That was always my secret superpower.
After high school, Colin and I fell out of touch for a while, but his mom and my mom stayed close. Every now and then, I'd hear stories about the artists Colin was touring or recording with. At one point, his mom sent me a CD in the mail of something called the Devil's Workshop Big Band.
She had said, like, oh, it's a big band, but they improvise their songs. And I was like, what? Like, what? That felt like you had ascended to, like, the level of wizardry to me.
Huh.
And I remember putting it in, and it starts off, and it's this kind of, like, murky, exploratory...
Wow, you remember it well.
Atonal. I've listened to that CD hundreds of times. All the other projects I'd ever heard you play on, I felt like I could hear your sound. And in this, I was like, I actually can't, I don't know if I can hear which one's Colin. And I mean that as a compliment. Cause like,
I take it as a compliment. Yeah.
It was like, he's just a part of this organism. For a while in our 20s, Colin and I both lived in New York City. I was trying to be an actor and he was trying to be a saxophonist. I always meant to reach out, but I never did. I felt embarrassed that my creative career wasn't going anywhere. And I imagined Colin was taking Greenwich Village by storm, playing jazz gigs every night of the week. In all the years we both lived there, I only saw him once. There was this one night where I had this terrible argument with my girlfriend at the time, where she was justifiably like, look, you gotta figure something out here. Like, this isn't gonna work. It was one of those where you like kind of like shout and cry yourself to a place where it's like, I don't even really have anything else left to say. Let's go get some ice cream. So we like leave the apartment and we walk down the block into this bodega and you're there with your guitar on your shoulder. And I was like, oh my God, there's Colin. He's like here in New York, he's got his gig bag. Like he's doing the thing. I can't believe he's seeing me right now, like at this moment.
Well, it's probably leaving the apartment that I shared with my girlfriend. Where it felt like every other conversation led to a fight, and oftentimes coming down to like you need to figure out a plan for this. Like if it's to be music, I mean of course that's classic. Like you see me with a gig bag,
right? I'm like you probably just played at Lincoln Center.
Yeah, of course it's something huge,
right?
Probably
right,
like
right,
going
right.
down to set up my horn and busk for
busk
a bit.
Yeah, yeah. Turns out Colin was not playing gigs in Greenwich Village every night. His career wasn't going the way he wanted either. And not long after I saw him in the bodega that night, he left New York.
I like rode my bike to Prospect Heights, chained it up, and like had like a goodbye New York moment.
Really?
Left the bike there.
Really?
And like rented an SUV.
Uh-huh.
And drove myself down to Virginia to lick the wounds. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Colin moved to Charlottesville and started producing albums at a recording studio.
It felt like a new chapter in my life, and I was no longer an instrumentalist at that point. I was a producer, and the saxophones went in the closet.
Years went by. Colin met a woman, had a couple kids, and one night he was working in the studio with a trumpeter, and he realized something.
There wasn't a single part of me that thought, I was wondering, I was like, is there going to be a part of me that like wishes I was playing on these songs? Oh, I'm not lying to myself. I mean, I was like, oh, I'm exactly where I want to be. I want to be hearing how we capture these musicians.
Obviously though, at some point, I mean, we're sitting here today because you decided to get the instruments back out.
Right.
So how did that happen?
Right.
Earlier this year, Colin got a call from Chris Baio, the bassist in Vampire Weekend. They were looking for a sax player. Someone gave him Colin's name. And when I found out Colin was on tour with one of the biggest rock bands in the world, I thought, well, it finally happened. Colin became a rock star. But then I saw this video of the band playing at Coachella. You pick up the saxophone and you start playing and the camera goes behind you and there's 100,000 people in a field in front of you. The thought I had in that moment, I don't know if I'm going to be able to articulate it, is like the look on your face was not, I've arrived. I'm obviously just, you know, watching you and trying to figure out what you're thinking. It didn't even really seem like you were thinking about all the people. It seemed like you were just like, what am I going to play here? Like it seemed like you were so much more focused on the gig. Just stay within yourself and like hit the notes.
100%. What I've really been looking to do is like be part of a sound and not necessarily like blow sheets of sound on my instrument.
It was never about people looking at you.
No, it's never been about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm just a side man.
Well, when we were growing up, I always wondered what it would feel like to be Colin Killily. And side man is probably the last thing I would have guessed. But a few weeks after that show at Arizona Financial Theater, Colin sent me a voice memo.
Yo! Hey, man. I've been thinking about you. I hope all's well. I'm back in Virginia.
with the fam. We're just settling back into the Virginia thing. I'm driving to work right now at that studio down the road. And it's weird, but it is good to be back.
For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman. This is the Devil's Workshop Big Band. I'm still not sure which part is Colin.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.